Hello, everyone, and welcome to JFG Tonight. I am here with our friend James, and we are getting ready for a discussion on the subject of property. I've been asking myself some questions around property recently. When you think about the Palestinians being kicked out of their home, the Israelis move in, the army helps, but private individuals take over your farm. I've been thinking about property being defended by regimes and empires, but eventually those empires fall, the lands get taken by other people. When is it that property is defended? When is it that it is not? And the history of its origins, in my view, its origins deep into biology and into pasts that are not just when we were monkeys or when we were rats protecting food from each other, but rather when we were bacteria and when we were viruses and we started wrapping ourselves with protective layers to keep our molecules from being used equally by the other side. That is when property was born, in my view. James, how are you doing first?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
I'm doing good. Now, don't move too much, because when I frame you for you are centered, but you decenter yourself, perhaps in a way that you don't have feedback on. But whenever you have chosen a position, let me know, and I'll select that frame. So, James, okay. You've been an audience member for a long time, and I know that you are a very intelligent guy. You've been making videos on Nietzsche and that kind of stuff, and I've been listening to it. I know you are a student of history and philosophy. How would you introduce yourself to our listeners who don't know about you?
Well, I'm just a very curious guy. I find history very fascinating. I don't like to go about history, though, in the typical way where a lot of people, they focus so much on the typical narrative and the structure of it all, when really there's big key movements throughout history. And some historians, they'll just get focused on certain pottery and certain changes that happened to different cultures, like where did this culture move at this certain time, when the momentous things, the things that really matter, really come down to ourselves and our biological nature. And I don't know, it's tough to describe yourself, but I guess you'll just get to see myself as we do this show.
Based on what you just said, though, would you say that most of history is a cataloging of events and dates, and rather than a mechanistic understanding? Are you after a mechanistic understanding of how theory happens? How history happens, sorry.
Well, it is a bunch of dates. It is a bunch of events. It happens 1 second after the next. There isn't, like, sure, there are big movements and ideologies, but if you only get focused on these big ideologies, the problem is you get lost in how one day transformed to the next. Like, yesterday was almost identical to today, but it's slightly different. And these slow, minute changes happen in history, and people get lost in thinking that everything was one way because we called a certain ideology. And then the next 100 years later, it's called a different ideology. And so people think totally different. Like, mm-hmm. even with, like, say, ideologies like Christianity, for one reason. People, the Christians of 1,000 years ago were very different than the Christians of today. And then the Christians of 2,000 years ago were very different than the Christians of 1,000 years ago. And for plenty of other different religions and ideologies, it works that same way, because you learn all of your information from the people around you and mostly from your family. And so when you learn these things from these people so close to you, and even before the internet, that was so much more important, that you're really informed by your surroundings. And so when we get so caught up in the labels of history, we don't see the forest for the trees, and to put it in an analogy.
That's interesting to think of detachment between the labels of the ideas and their progression into the future, as if basically, let's take the mental Christianity carried forward like a shell of a sea animal, like a mollusk, carrying that shell takes them forward in time. But then suddenly the Christians, let's say Christianity is adopted by Europe, and suddenly it's no more just this fringe religion of the Middle East. It's now the religion of white people, and they carry that mantle forward, but the mantle is merely the label, and all of it is subject to change and historical minute progressions, like you described.
Yeah. And like we'll see in this very show, there are religious practices of Indo-European peoples. Specifically, we'll focus on the Italians and the Greeks. But there's some of these practices, like, for the example, carrying the bride over the threshold. This was a practice 3,000 years ago. You would carry her over the threshold to signify that you were taking her as a wife. And back in those days, she would feign a struggle to act like she was resisting. But it was a show. It was an all an act for the purpose of showing that, she was leaving her gods and joining your gods, because your gods were not the gods of the city, the gods of the whole nation, the religion. They were personal family gods that you had, and she had to leave her religion to join yours. And
that is fascinating. Basically, yeah. Imagined rape as a mechanism pre-marriage, whereas in modernity you have false allegations of rape coming as part of the divorce tradition.
Yes.
I'm already stunned. This is what I like about James. And by the way, for those who were not here yesterday, I explained that James is joining basically the show as a co-host. We'll be here relatively regularly whenever we have an idea, whenever he has a thesis to share. It might be every month sometimes. It might be every week sometimes. But this is, this is what I like about him. He brings details of history that strike me as very important always. So let's get started on the concept of property. You have read some works by Numa Denis Fustel de Coulanges, a Frenchman who seems based by his beard, but I don't know anything else about him.
Yes, I haven't researched too much about him either, but I know every single bit about his books. So I think that's the more important thing. But I do know a little bit, so I'll say a little bit, because that's generally not my focus. I don't care so much about their personal life. But I guess he was a Frenchman around the 18... He wrote from the 1860s to the late 1880s. He was a Frenchman that witnessed the loss of France to the Prussians, which was the Germans, in the Franco-Prussian War. And he was highly influenced by this, and he wrote a lot of works that were patriotic towards France, and more of the aristocratic tradition towards France, not the libertine kind of revolutionary tradition that was happened 80 years earlier. But there was still a strong aristocratic tradition at this time. And so he was that type of man. But these works don't so much focus on that, but he that was focused on that. But he was mostly an academic. And what I get from his writings is he's a highly detailed man, where he will focus on the source documents and go from source document to source document and examine them as they were. Archaeology was still in a primitive state back then, but still, even for his time, he didn't care that much about archaeology. he cared mostly on the source documents. And I guess I would share some affinity with him in that. But yeah, should I just get right into it, or do you have something else to say?
And it is said on his Wikipedia page that he had an understanding of Greek text and Roman text, was capable of looking at it straight without translation. And so that makes you a pioneer from the start if you can do this and develop your own opinions about what's really written there. All right, so property. Is interest in property, where does that stem from? And what are we talking about when we talk of property?
Well, I wanted to read the quote because I think it gives us a good introduction to his work. Starting from the Ancient City, page 78, here are three things from which, from most ancient times, we find founded and solidly established in Greek and Italian societies: the domestic religion, the family, and the right of property. Those three things: the domestic religion, the family, and the right of property. Three things from which, in the beginning, a manifest relation which appear to have been inseparable. The idea of private property existed in the religion itself. Every family had a hearth and its ancestors. These gods could be adored only by this family and protected it alone. They were its property. When they established the hearth, it was with the thought and hope that it always remained in the same spot. The god is installed there not for a day, not for the life of one man merely, but for as long as the family shall endure. And there remains anyone to support its fire by sacrifices. Thus, the sacred fire takes possession of the soil and makes it its own.
This is a weirdly unified vision of concepts that we tend to treat separately almost in modernity. Family, religion, and property being seen all together as a inseparable triangle.
Yes, that's the very, see, it's going to be a very difficult to comprehend understanding of these very early notions of these people, because it wasn't like it fully encapsulated when you say this is their religion, because this was their entire worldview. It was pre-scientific. They didn't have objective scientific notions about the world. Every part of it was influenced by their, well, subjective opinions, you might even put it, where, like, say, the boundaries of their land, the fences, it was called the termini, the terminus, and it was considered a god, and they would offer sacrifices to it. Their central fire where they do their cooking was considered a god. Many other parts, just things around their house that were important to the family, were so-called gods. So, I mean, when you consider all these things important to them, it kind of, our understanding of the word God doesn't really quite translate to a complete understanding of this. So it's going to be something that it takes a while to really understand how people actually thought back then, because they thought in a radically different way than we do today.
Yeah, I don't think it's that hard. As Puzin points out, we get it on the regular chat. It's not that counterintuitive. I had an anthropology professor who had found nice words to describe this. He said the modernity itemizes the understanding of every concept, whereas the tribal and more ancient past of humanity has an integrated, holistic view, where, for example, if you look into Native American societies, they had a conception of nature that was that you can call a religion, or you can call it a conception of nature. They were seeing the trees around them as having powers, the plants around them as having special powers. So I think we get it. It's a very unified view. When you don't have the itemized modern scientific technocratic division between so many categories, you understand the fire in your wood stove as a form of God.
Okay. Then I will move on to the next thing I was going to talk about. the virtuous man and the wicked man, as well as a good man and a bad man, they all became gods after they died. The ancestors, this was ancestor worship. And so their bad inclinations or good inclinations tormented them after death. And after death, they didn't go to a separate realm. They were placed in the ground, and they thought that they just lived in the ground and they had a second life there. And so they would pour out, they called them libations, like food and water, and place them on the grave. And the grave was right outside their family door, and they could greet them every single day. And it made it so how they're always remembering their family and giving libations to them. And this was how it was formulated back then.
Very interesting. And, so can I think of God's polytheism, you know, how it is very contrasted with the modern monotheism that we have in most places of the world? Can I think that the many gods were basically standing statues of heroes, of ancestors, of people who actually existed, and that God ultimately was not meant to present them as super powerful, supernatural beings, but that they were more the great-great-grandfathers that led to humanity existing?
Precisely. That's how it was. Their gods were their ancestors, and that was the original term for gods. And this is how even the pantheon of later they formulated into Zeus and the whole pantheon of gods in ancient Greece and Rome. This was a later development of the family, and there were similar archetypes that they just brought together when all the families came into a city in Greece and Rome, and they brought these together and all agreed upon or just had a decentralized, agreed upon way of figuring out certain names for these. But yes, each family had their own gods, and it was that's how it was. It was their heroes and gods.
And something that we can trace back, we can trace down to Judaism, you know, how they refer to in the Bible, in the Ancient Testament, how they refer to houses of ancestors of very important people who are said to have given birth to subset of the modern Jewish populations back then. I think there is a parallel to be made here. Perhaps Christianity and Islam would be the two religions that didn't have this kind of ancestor gods.
Yahweh is the god of Judaism, and he is derived from two different gods, Yahweh and El. And originally, they were separate gods, and there was a few different gods. It was the local gods around them. And a very interesting thing about Judaism is it... you're right. It amalgamized into one god very quickly when everyone else around them was still worshiping many gods. And so that is a very interesting thing about Judaism.
You're talking about the gods, but I'm thinking, for example, about Abraham. And I don't know the details. It's been a while since I have read about this. But a couple of years ago, I was reading text about the Ancient Testament. And you have Abraham and a couple of other of important ancestors of the ancient text that give rise somehow to the Jews of whatever time it was written, which was perhaps a couple thousand years ago. Anyways, that was just a comment en passant. So we are back to Greek and Roman. So we have an integration of God, family, ancestors. What then?
Yes. Well, the domestic religion, what was it like? For a great number of centuries, the human race invented no religious doctrine except two conditions. That first, they proclaim one God, and second, that it was addressed to all men. as we know with Christianity. This is what we typically know. But systematically rejecting no race and class. But this primitive religion fulfilled neither of these conditions. None of these offered only one God to the adoration of all men. They did not offer themselves the gods of the human race. They did not even resemble the Brahma, who was a god to the whole class, nor the Pan-Hellenic Zeus, the god of the entire nation. The primitive religion could be adored only by one family. And now, let's zero in on the family here.
Now, just to be clear, the primitive religion we're talking about, is it Greece or Rome?
Well, they these people, it's really both. It's like 3000 BC. When they go back into the text, these people had a, we're talking about the outline of the traditional beliefs, and they're a decentralized people to where there's, of course, a ton of individual differences in all these people, but we're looking at the core things that made them different back then.
Okay.
And there was a law, therefore, that forbade a stranger to approach the tomb. The worship of the dead was nothing more than the worship of the ancestors. The man who died without leaving a son received no offerings and is exposed to perpetual hunger. Every man in his tomb where its dead want to repose, one after another, always together. This tomb is always near the house, not far from the door, in order to say, none of the ancients, that the sons, in entering and leaving their dwelling, might always meet their fathers and might always address them with the invocation. Thus, religion dwelt not in temples, but in the house. Each house had its gods, and each god protected one family only, and was a god only in one house. And we cannot reasonably suppose that the religion of this character was revealed to man in the powerful imagination of one among them, and that was taught to them by a priestly class. It grew up spontaneously in the human mind, and its cradle was the family. Each family created its own gods. And so as I'm laying this out, we need to understand a lot of these baseline things before we can go too deep in discussing the theory that I want to get into later. So if you don't mind, I want to get through some details, and then maybe we'll have a lot more free open discussion in a bit.
Puzim on the regular chat says, memeing was hard in those times. Yes, that is also what I understand from the statement there. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Religion was transmitted only from male to male. That was owing, no doubt, to the idea that generation was due entirely to the males. This reproductive power resided exclusively in the father. This father alone possessed the mysterious principle of existence, transmitted the spark of life. From this old notion, it followed the domestic worship and always passed from male to male. That was, a woman participated in it only through the father or her husband. And finally, after death, women had not the same part as men in the worship, in the ceremonies at the funeral meal. So we see, obviously, that genetic, the passing down of the religion or the family was from male to male, and they saw in this the reproductive seed as the power for this, and that was their opinion.
Fascinating, because you're talking about basically a father would be in front of a family. Perhaps there were loose siblings, cousins amassing around single males with their wife. They were in ancient times, and they were praising their male ancestors, which were buried just next door, basically. That's what you're telling us. You're presenting us a spark of religion, of primitive religion, in which the reproduction act, the marriage, and the religion were all the same thing. And you were basically not joining a church as a social event with other genetic entities that are unrelated to you. You were joining really a family.
Yeah. And the thing about religion for the female was she was born into her religion and it was hers, her family. But when she married, she left her religion and joined the new religion of her husband. And her husband's religion became her new religion and she followed it. So it always passed through the male line. And this is actually the origin of all of the laws of succession throughout, well, most of human history, like we see with kings and dukes and princes, where they have what's called primogeniture succession, where how do we know who gets the lands of the king and gets certain lands? Well, it's the firstborn son and mm-hmm. so on. These are the origin of these laws.
Fascinating.
So as we transport ourselves in thought to these ancient generations of men, we find in each house an altar. Around this altar, a family assembled. The family meets every morning to address its prayers to the sacred fire, in the evening to invoke it for the last time. In the course of the day, the members are assembled near the fire for a meal, and they partake piously after prayer and libation. In these religious acts, hymns, which their fathers handed down and sung in common by the family, outside their house, near at hand, in the neighboring fields, there is a tomb, the second home of the family. And several generations of ancestors repose there together. Death has not separated them. They remain grouped in this second existence and continue to form an indissoluble family. So as we see, like, they continue to think of them as family even after death.
The way today we would think of our loved ones who are dead as discussing with each other in heaven.
Yes, yes, yes. But for some reason, they think they still exist underneath the ground. And I guess who's to say which seems more ridiculous? But for us, it probably seems far more ridiculous. To me, at least, it seems very ridiculous that they think that they live underneath the ground when you could just dig up their bodies and see that they're rotting. But
I think it's actually more connected to reality. You have an observation here. And whatever their molecules are, they are doing some work.
Exactly. And for some reason, I forget the exact term, but I remember they called them larvae for some reason when they were in the ground.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know the origin of this word. Maybe it comes from this religion, or I don't know the exact etymology, but it just struck me that they would use that term there.
That's fascinating. Because maybe one comes from the other, but I don't know in which direction, because a larva does look like a wrapped human body that's dead. That strikes me as a resemblance.
I wish I would have looked up that etymology before this, yeah.
Oh, but that's on our to-do list. All right, let's keep going, because we're not yet at the property.
Yes, we're getting very close.
Well, we are at the inheritance, yes. In a way, we are already there.
Yes. Two families live side by side, but they have different gods. One daughter, actually, I kind of mentioned this one already when I talked about how, so we'll go on to the next. Father gives his daughter to the young man, declaring him absolutely indispensable to the marriage, for the young girl will not be able to go to worship at the hearth of her husband if her father is not separated from her paternal hearth. To enable her to adopt her new religion, she must be freed from every bond that attaches to her first religion. The bride dares not go by her own accord to her new dwelling. Her husband must take her and simulate a seizure by force, must cry out in the women that accompany her, pretend to defend her. By what right this symbol of modesty of the bride? This is hardly probable. The moment for shame, or what is now to take place, is a religious ceremony. Was it not to mark more strongly that the wife, who was now to sacrifice to the fire, had herself no right there, and that she did not approach it of her own free will, and that the master of this place and of the god introduced by the act of this power? However this may be, after a feigned struggle, the husband raises her in his arms, carries her through the doorway, taking of great care, however, that her feet do not touch the sill. And so We did talk about that.
Reminds me of one of my girlfriends. I call her the octopus woman. She I had to carry her out of my apartment.
Wow. I would be scared to see the genetic deformities on that woman.
So why is he carrying out his wife out of the home? Because she has lost her rights as a wife?
It's a symbol of the seizure of the woman in taking it for her own. There's one very interesting example of this in Rome when it's the founding of the city of Rome. The men, they didn't have women, and they obviously wanted women because in this ancient religion, to start a religion, to start a new family, you needed a wife and you needed to start having children to worship yourself and have ancestors. And so they invited the Sabine tribe to a feast with them, and they killed all the men and took all their wives. And that is how Rome was hit by the seizure of the Sabine women.
Okay, and so it's a kidnapping, basically.
Yeah, and so, I mean, we're not looking at the past and saying this was some libertarian utopia and that property rights were something from John Locke and defended this way. But the interesting thing about property rights back then were that they weren't just an idea in people's heads. They were this religious notion that people wouldn't want to trample upon because they had some superstitious notion that it would bring them bad luck or other things that would bring them misfortune. And so the really interesting thing about property was it was defended and almost sustained itself through this lie, but it was a lie that all of these religious notions, but it worked and it created a strong property right that existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. So I just found that, I don't know, it's fascinating how that existed.
Well, yeah, lie may not be the right term here because, like, if I see the teeth of a monkey and the monkey holds a banana, I will respect the banana. I will be like, those thieves could injure me. Now, those thieves didn't injure me, and never did a monkey bite me. But it's more like if you see a fence as holy, and I don't want to violate that fence, it may be a sign that danger is ahead. And even if the danger doesn't instantiate itself, it's not so much a lie, but a warning sign.
Yes, because I see where you're going, because even if, obviously, the fence doesn't hold any magical powers that can hurt you, the people around it believe it. And so if you do violate it, it won't be just that family. Other families might offend that family, and there might be repercussions just upon this belief.
And so the fence, not even being solid, becomes a contract. It becomes a piece of paper. And the piece of paper represents all of the combined effort of the potential response. The human response, just like the teeth of the monkey are showing me a potential danger when he's like, argh!
Yes, that implicit contract. That's a very interesting notion. Shall I go on?
Yes, keep going.
Okay. The extinction of the family always causes the ruin of the family, obviously, given that because the ideas of these people don't exist out in the ether somewhere. They exist within the physical representation of these people. So that's something very unique in this religion. At Athens, the law made it the duty of the first magistrate of the city to see that no family should become extinct. In the same way, the Roman law made provision that no family should fall or become extinct. So even at this later time, because we know about this from Roman and Greek writers writing about earlier times, and they looking up old laws on the books, and they would recognize that even though a family was falling, low or something like that, they would always try to see that it wouldn't go extinct. And my thought on this is, it seems like the first start of a genetic life that doesn't want to reproduce being supported by the state to stay alive. So my libertarian leanings are coming back out, but it's like they're helping the pandas fuck so that they can save their species. So this is where I see my libertarian mind sees the state trying to ruin this relationship of family being genetically successful.
Did you just present to us the root in humanity of social welfare or maybe even LGBT activism? We're going to take your sperm and we're going to find a way to make it have a baby, even if you don't want. Well, that is a form of communism, a form of genetic communism that somehow, but perhaps you can also see it as a contract tying the original ancestors, meaning, look, I know that your great-great-grandfather didn't totally kill my great-great-grandfather because we're both alive. So I have some duty of honoring your life so that you can continue the line of your great-grandfather, knowing that he respected enough my great-great-grandfather such that both of us would exist.
Yeah. And I could see that. I mean, these people intermarried sometimes. I don't know. I'm not totally convinced, but I can see your point.
I don't know. I'm throwing it out there. Maybe yes. if you want to not see this as communism or the help of the lowest parts of society, they are maintaining some lines of existence for all distinguishable families.
Yeah. And right. If you have more lines of descent out there that are related to you culturally, then there are more potential genetic partners. And like, say if you're part of like a Welsh culture and there's only 10 Welsh people left, that's really bad for you reproductively because you tend to reproduce better within your culture. And so within your city, if your city's not doing too good, then yeah. So it almost seems like I think about group selection, but it's not, because helping out one another's is genetically good for your genetic kin, and there are justifications for it. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's move ahead.
In the views and opinions, celibacy was a grave impiety and a misfortune. An impiety because one who did not marry put the happiness of the family in peril. A misfortune because he himself would receive no worship after death and could not know what the family enjoyed. Both for himself and his ancestors, it was a sort of damnation. Obviously, for these people, it goes without saying, sex was very important and a key to the continuation of their line of descent. Dionysus of Halicarnassus also searched the annals of Rome and asserts that he sees an old law in the books that required young people to marry. At Sparta, the man who did not marry lost all his rights of citizenship. So we see even at these later times, there still were laws that enforce the institution of marriage.
Illegal incel.
This marriage.
You can't be an incel in Sparta. Incels. You cannot be an incel in Sparta by law. There's your solution for the modern world.
Yes. Exactly. Nick Fuentes would have hated Sparta.
Ouch! Ouch. Okay, let's continue.
I'm just kidding. This marriage, having been contracted only to persuade the family, it seemed just that it should be broken if his wife was sterile. The right of divorce in this case always existed among the ancients. It is even possible that divorce was an obligation. Herodotus mentions two kings of Sparta who were constrained to repudiate their wives on account of sterility. And we even see this on the opposite side too. If the male is sterile, he will get a he will do this in return.
So we're talking about not divorce because I don't love you anymore, but divorce if you cannot produce children.
Yes, yes. As we see continually, the reinforcing the idea that children was the most important thing to this religion.
All right.
Now, for a property, Greece and Italy, from the earliest antiquity, always held to the idea of private property. We do not find an age when the soil was common among them. And we see that this private property was indivisible. I mean, you couldn't divide it between any of the children. And this private property was a part of the family. It was a part of the religion. And these three things, as I said in the beginning, the domestic religion, the family, and the property, these were inseparable from each other. And this was the foundation for all of this. Now, what happened? I mean, why did people stop believing in all this? Where did it go? Well, the things with they got grouped into cities, and because it made for better defense. And when you went into cities, they had to form gods that would represent more than one family. And so when you would represent more than one family, you would amalgamate similar attributes of gods and form a pantheon of gods like we know in Greece and Rome. And so when this happens, the family religion is undermined, and these ideas still exist in the mind of some people, but they're not as strong. And we even have one example from earlier times where there was this commander of a Athenian fleet, and he was a very educated man. He was educated by a lot of philosophers, and he didn't really believe in this domestic religion. He believed in dualism in a way, because that was a popular, the separation of mind and soul. This is a popular philosophy at the time. And well, anyways, he won a great victory, and he didn't bother burying the dead. He let the corpses drift away at sea. And when he came back, the people of Athens killed all of the commanders because they didn't recover their ancestors to live in the ground underneath there. And so by winning this great victory, he condemned all of their ancestors to eternal suffering in the sea. And so you can see how important these things were to these people. But yet it was slowly being eroded away. And as it was being eroded away, it was filled by other concepts like the natural rights of property under the law. But a lot of these are just justifications. And while they have to be enforced by the state, and so we can see how the state really enforced all of this and created its structures, it really wasn't possible when the family was strong. So when there's a strong family, there's a weak state. And when the family gets undermined, then the state can come in and overpower the family structure.
Very interesting. So if I was to summarize your thesis, is it that the collectivization of religion and its institutionalization is already an attack on this small independent system of family religions? And it was already an attack that gave a central power to something that humanity hadn't had before, and that opened the door, although it may not have happened everywhere, but it opened the door for a religion that's fundamentally hostile to the interest of the family and the continuity.
I would say that. And the problem is, though, that it wasn't these ideas of the family. Yes, they were genetically good for the family. It made it so that they were able to reproduce at a, it was in a great way. They were able to parent their children the right way that we can see now as rational people, and we can justify through arguments. But this was just their beliefs for them. But the philosophers of the age, they would disprove this religion. And in disproving this religion, it undermined the genetic success of these people. And that is what undermined their civilization and caused it to fall. And sure, we have invented other ideologies of thought. And there are certain parts of, say, Christianity that support the family very strongly. We have many other doctrines that are good for your genetic success. But it was always this search for the truth in humans that undermined this initial lie in a way that was good for your genes. But but the problem is now that it we're so far past that, that what are we doing here? We're trying to talk about the truth. And so are we undermining our genes by talking about the truth now? Is that like the meta question of this? I don't think so. I think
depends. Depends if you've had sex before the show or after.
Oh. Well.
But if showing up on this show occupies so much your autism that you don't get a girlfriend, I guess we could say that it's a disadvantage. But I actually have an alternative hypothesis, because it's not even an alternative hypothesis. I don't think your lens is bad here. I think, okay, you say it's the philosophical pursuit of the truth that has undermined this system of signaling that was just good for people then. What if I was to present another lens where it is not the search for the truth that has led to this conflict, that it is a bureaucratic class of military management that we can see it as the whole state of today, or we can see it as the growing state then. But there is a class of humans that specialize in parasitizing those family structures that worked to recruit their energy to their own service. And what if I was to, it's a more vicious hypothesis about what went on, where these families weren't deceived into leaving their beliefs because they were invalid. They were deceived into leaving their belief to the interest of another class of humans who used them as soldiers for the perpetuation of their own tradition, the tradition of the bureaucratic statist.
Well, would you say that these people never intermarried with, you would have to justify that these people are another class of people and that they never intermarried with the people
they
that
might intermarry, in which case you could say, well, there were some genetic interests that transferred. Of course there must have been. But my point is there were fundamentally new genes rising into humanity here. The genes of, hey, stop adoring your ancestor, but present just a white bearded man in the sky as being to be adored by everyone around you, and this will give you power to recruit their sword, recruit their lives at the defense of your own interest, and eventually to tax them and to live off them. Now, think of it not so much as a separate group of people, but think of it as an overlapping gene pool that goes into a different natural selection direction.
Like a specific trait, a genetic trait for this bait that catches these people. And whoever has this bait gene that catches people because they are... for whatever reason, their focus on the family causes them to maybe look for defending those around them that you said, like they go into the military, they go into these civil things that are good for the state and good for those around them. And so it's like a bait around them to get to recruit their powers for them around them and
absolutely
live them like.
So instead of thinking of the original state of the family god as a lie that got undermined by the pursuit of truth, think of the philosophical underlying of a parasitizing signal over this as being the lie. The great lie is, hey, you're going to die for Canada. You're going to die for the United States. The great lie is this much more than you're going to die for your own son.
Yes, but at the same time, we look for this pursuit of truth, and it did undermine the actual falseness of this religion. And so it was false, and we undermined it, and it was true, and I don't know how to put this. That,
but did it happen?
Because I can
ever
see what you're saying.
Did one of these family patriarch ever say, "Oh, I realize the falsehood of my previous beliefs"? Thank you, Greek philosophers. This didn't happen. You know what I'm saying? That's I'm just pointing to the fact that you seem to have developed a post hoc intellectual understanding of the historical transition between these periods. Whereas there could be a more organic understanding where what's going on here is a balance of biological power shifting from one model to another model.
I see where you're going with that. And it's very interesting because if we consider all of these things, is there any fight for the people that have this? Because they're like fish in a pond that are attracted to the shiny baits, the people in the family.
Yes, absolutely.
And is there any way out for them then? Because the state exists, and there seems to be no way of really undermining it. So is this like a ultimate black pill from you? What is your thought on that?
It wouldn't be a black pill because there's so much resistance possible. There are people who are fleeing the state recruitment, and some of them get caught, but some of them don't get caught. There is a tradition of opposing Canadian intervention, for example, in World War II by the Quebecois, who were voting in referendums at 97%, we don't want to get engaged in World War II. Maybe it's the fact that I come from this culture that it strikes me immediately that that the state doesn't have full power. It has parasitized the signal to a certain extent. It has taken the willing fish, the fish that were willing to bite the bait, but that there is ultimately a limit to the system. And that limit is the kind of limit that is met by something like the Roman Empire facing the barbarian invasions and ultimately just crumbling from it. Ultimately saying there's just too many waves of people that we have to fight. We don't have enough soldiers to resist. So our recruitment effort is over. We have emptied our parasitic capacity, and the other side somehow didn't. And that's what leads to a barbarian invasion, making the fall of the Roman Empire.
Yeah. And well, the thing with the Roman Empire too is it was just replaced in a lot of ways genetically, because the barbarians that invaded, they lived there and they became citizens, and the people in the cities, well, they didn't really reproduce that much anymore. They lived in poor sanitary conditions. They were terribly killed by plagues. And at the end, they were so depopulated by the end that the people that were coming in were just filling empty spaces. And so they were really replaced. And so this bait of the large empire appeared to their genes in a way that made them feel very safe and reproduce at a good rate for a while. but it didn't work forever. They were eventually replaced by allowing others to take care of them and not care for their own genetic interest. And obviously these people that invaded, the same thing happened to them later on, but it's kind of a cycle. But this very interesting hypothesis you're raising here.
Well, you had very evocative thoughts tonight. It's all interesting. I throw the ideas out there. Not that I'm convinced of my hypothesis, but I think what you brought in terms of fact is very exciting to the mind. Now, as we are headed toward the end, I wanted to check with you. Did you lay out all of your thesis and everything you had to lay out tonight, or did you have more for us?
Well, I have a lot of facts that I've been writing down. And the problem I had with writing this show today was it's such a huge book and there's just so many facts. And I just really thought that there's not many people that who have covered this author. And I've always found his work so fascinating. And he doesn't lend himself very well to being discussed on a podcast or a YouTube show because there's just a ridiculous amount of facts and there's so much information to get through. But I hope it's been a bit of a weird show in that regard, but I really hope the audience has enjoyed it and learned something, because I'm not always going to bring something that's so content dense like this and tough to get through and kind of awkward in some ways.
But I don't think it was awkward at all. I think you made a distillation. I'm so happy that you did this for us, because I don't have time to go read all of the books of this guy, certainly. So I certainly need a mind that I trust to go out there and come to us. And I think that what you brought us is a line of thinking along those facts that is very mechanistic. I mean, it makes me dream of a theory of history to a certain extent. And people are sharing on the regular chat that they enjoyed it. Puzim says, it was nice. Frog Eyes says, I enjoyed it. Yeah, I think there is something to be taught there, that perhaps we have lost something when we abandoned this intimate tie between the small genetic network and the images of the gods that we use. Because when your god becomes this generic nationwide, adopted by millions of people, perhaps inherently it exposes the religion, the institution that controls it, to a form of parasitism that's inevitable, and that some people may take, as is the case in my hypothesis, may take advantage of.
Yeah, and one of those things that we talked about were originally these gods were ancestors and physical objects around them. They eventually became personified to physical representations of people. And in a way, it kind of lost the tangible quality to it, to seeing the physical things around them and seeing them as very important. And these obviously physical things around them for them was their property. And so they defend their house, their land with so much fervor. And they would care so much about these so-called property rights. They really were family property rights, not the individual property rights, but the whole family. And they would defend them so fervently because of how much they meant to them in their religion. And so one thing that we can take away from this is that private property is something that is extremely important to your genetic future. Because when it's taken away from you, you have a wife, but what if you're in some collective setting? What if she's around thousands of other men, and you don't know what she's doing out there? Your children are raised by the state because you're out in some housing with a thousand other people, and your children are influenced by the mind of everyone around them. They don't get your vision, and so when you have your property and you have actually the rights to teach your children just as your vision allows them, you get your thought process is not diluted by the state, these people around you. And so that was so important about property. And that is what we've lost. And I think that's what people should take away from this.
Fascinating. The picture that you present of the ancient pagan family, is that correct to call them pagan models of families?
Yeah, pagan's just like a general term for these people before Christianity. Okay. So yeah.
To me, it reminds me of the cone of the extended phenotype. And Lendl Guntram mentioned this on the regular chat, extended phenotype. If you want to consider all of your children, all of their children, all of their children, all of this is your phenotype. All of this is what you cause to exist in the world. And I believe that what you present here is a total alignment, where the home, the family, the religion was the extended phenotype of a male. I like it. I love it. And it opens the possibility. Oops, we just lost James. But it's okay. In my concluding remarks, I will say that we may have lost a lot. When you open the mimetic doors of the brains of your children, when you give control to institutions to determine the religion, when you then give control to the state for military recruitment, poof. All of these little mechanisms that could have existed in tying the tree together disappear. Just a couple of pictures. You know, I mentioned earlier in the discussion that larvae look like wrapped human bodies. That's because I had this in my mind. Look, this is a mommy. This is a larva. So I challenge people on the regular chat, find us the etymological origin of larva. Was the first use of the word larva for larva, or was it for mummies? But interestingly, it could be linked to this whole idea that the dead can be reborn, or whatever crap reincarnation type of stuff could have motivated this comparison. And Low Mercury Tunad sent a super chat. He says, how much is trans rage due to subjecting female central nervous system to 10 times the testosterone as they were designed for, and subjecting the male central nervous system to more estrogen than they were designed for? So basically, how much of the modern trans phenomenon is ultimately due to hormonal imbalance? That's a very good question. As far as I know, I don't know of any scientific evidence that it couldn't be 100% this. So, but when you start asking this, the way I would approach the problem is, first, let us quantify how much trans behavior, LGBT behavior, was there 200 years ago. If we could have a good quantification of this, how much of it is it now? And then get estimates of the changes in testosterone. And then you could start having statistical hypotheses, like maybe 50% of the phenomenon could be explained by this, maybe 100%. And let's not forget that there may be overlapping hypotheses. If you say the trans are trans because of testosterone imbalance, and I say the trans are trans because of public schools, you then have to ask, is it possible that it's both? Is it possible that the public school causes the testosterone imbalance? So you're not out of the woods. You can have overlapping statistical contribution where maybe the testosterone effect is 80%, maybe the public school effect is 80%, but there's an overlapping 60% because one causes the other. In the routes of considering causality in complex statistical systems like this, this is possible too. But I have no final answer to give you. But it could be 100%, it could be zero. That is it for tonight, and thank you for James for joining us tonight, even if we lost him during the process. But I'm glad that he came here, and he delivers quality. He's kind of an autistic guy of my kind. What he delivered tonight is very interesting food for thought. Much love, see you all tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you.